My name is Mike Smith. The topic I wanted to talk about today is Somalia, and I had a subheading something like, can it be put back together? Because my sense was that Somalia has just utterly fallen apart. But you may read the situation differently. I am a political scientist, and I am approaching this as a political science generalist who has studied various countries, and political scientists have developed ways of thinking about countries in other parts of the world, and I'm using that to apply to Somalia. I am not an expert on Somalia. I've tried to do some research to understand better the situation there. My hope is that you also know, at least some of you know, something about Somalia, and I would ask for your contributions. To the extent that you can contribute to our understanding of the situation in Somalia, that would be good. The situation there is one where we feel, where I think we're very concerned about what's happened to the people. We're concerned about the breakdown of government, and we feel that perhaps we can do something to improve the situation. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the situation in Somalia this week. My general theme this week, or my general concern, is humanitarian intervention. Are there cases where the United States ought to go in, or the United Nations ought to go in, because of the suffering of the people, to try to relieve that suffering and maybe in some ways use force to end suffering or end the problems that caused the suffering? So that's the general topic this week. Tomorrow I want to talk in general about the United States and what the United States can do about suffering in lots of places, whether it's Bosnia, which we talked about on Monday, whether it's Somalia, whether it's a place like Haiti, or whether it's some other place where there is a great deal of human suffering. On Friday, I want to talk about the United Nations and the roles that the United Nations can play in dealing with these sorts of situations. So I invite all of you to come back tomorrow and Friday, or tomorrow or Friday, if you're interested in those more general kinds of discussions. What I plan to do today is begin by looking a little bit at the map. I don't know how well you can see the map, but we'll get some general kind of impression of Somalia from the map. I want to talk about fairly recent history of Somalia, go on from that then to try to analyze and understand the problem or problems that Somalia is facing. It seems to me that you can say that Somalia has several different problems, and depending on what problem you identify as the central problem that you're concerned with, I think the possible solutions vary, and whether the United States or the United Nations has any capacity to make a difference varies depending on what you say the problem is. So my plan is very briefly a little bit of geography, go from that to history, and then to an analysis of the problems in Somalia. Starting with the geography, Somalia is on what is known as the Horn of Africa. So if you look up in this area, this is the horn. It has sometimes been considered to be a strategic location because of its proximity to the Gulf of Aden, which leads into the Red Sea, which leads then to the Suez Canal. So there's a fair amount of shipping. When the Suez Canal is open, there's a fair amount of shipping that passes that way. And of course, it's also relatively close to Saudi Arabia. As you will see when we get into the history of the place, the connections Somalia has had have changed. At one point it was aligned with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union built a major naval base in Somalia. Later on it switched sides and was aligned with the United States, and so we inherited the Soviet naval base in the same way that they inherited a major naval base we built in Vietnam when Vietnam fell. So we build these things, and then they shift back and forth, and we use each other's resources. The capital is Mogadishu, is down here, and most of the cities I think that you will have heard about, as you've heard about the relief efforts in Somalia, are in this more southern part of Somalia. And you can look at the map more later. One other thing I would mention is that it has been broken in two. It was originally broken in two. There were two. There was Italian Somaliland and British Somaliland. They were united when Somalia was created, and it the northern chunk broke away a couple years ago, and the rest is in such disorder that it has not had the capacity to try to reunite the countries. So it's presently two rather than one. I'm not sure exactly where that border runs. It's somewhere along here is where that border is, so that this is presently a separate entity. But I'm not certain that anyone's recognized it, so I'm not certain that the international community regards it as a separate entity, but it has split off. Okay, let's look at the history. Somalia was formed in 1960 from a British colony and an Italian colony. The borders of that we were looking at a moment ago are not really the borders of the Somali people. Now, far and away, most of the people in Somalia are Somali, but there are substantial numbers of Somali people, or at least in the past there were, in what is Ethiopia. And this led to a brief war between Somalia and Ethiopia some years ago, as Somalia said, well, we're going to take that chunk of Ethiopia where Somali people live, and there are also Somali people in Kenya. So the as you will find in much of Africa, the borders are relatively arbitrary borders. The colonial powers drew borders, and that's what the countries are stuck with. And the general attitude in Africa has been, leave borders alone. So many countries have borders that are troublesome that way, with ethnic groups spilling over the borders, that once you say in one country you can change your borders, there are a whole lot of other countries where the same could apply. And so the general norm in Africa is we don't mess around with that. The first several years, Somalia had a democratic government, as we would regard it. And then in 1969, this dictator, Siad Barre, took power and controlled Somalia for a couple decades, basically. Initially, Siad Barre was pro-Soviet, and I think that was probably primarily because Ethiopia, the neighbor that the Somalis really can't stand very much, because Ethiopia was pro-U.S., so Somalia was pro-Soviet.
That's when Haile Selassie was
the... Haile Selassie would still be around, I think, in the late 60s. I'm not sure when he was toppled. Howard, do you know? Was when?
I don't know exactly.
Ah, okay. So perhaps the successor regime was Western, and then later you have some radicals who come to power in Ethiopia, and when they align with the Soviet Union, then as I say here, when they align with the Soviet Union, then Somalia responded very quickly and switched sides and decided it liked the United States better than the Soviet Union. Yeah, the most maps showed the Ogaden as being Ethiopian, but the Somalis said, no, that's really ought to be ours. The government of this dictator was not terribly popular government. It was a harsh government. There was a coup attempt against him in 1978, and then a movement to oust him from power formed in 1981. I'm not sure how much of a role they played in his eventual removal from power, but I put this up just to indicate that this was not a terribly popular government. These are signs of that. The civil war itself began in 1988, the civil war that led to his ouster from power, and a number of the clans in Somalia were opposed to Barre and supported the effort to drive him from power. Finally, in January of 1991, he fled the country. What has happened since that time is a lot of fighting, and some of this seems to be clan violence. Some of this is the warlord. There seems to be, the country has become very violent, and that's part of what I you know, I think we are all aware of and we're concerned about is that situation. May of 1991, then this northern chunk, the Republic of Somaliland, breaks away. I tried to compare maps of Italian Somaliland versus British, and it doesn't exactly correspond to the old colonies, but it's relatively close. So I'm not certain how much that old colonial boundary affected it, or if it's just these are the boundaries of the clans, and so those northern clans broke away. March 1992, the UN negotiated a ceasefire between two of the leading warlords, we call them, Muhammad Farah Aidid, that we are hearing a lot about lately, and Ali Mahdi Muhammad. There was and continued to be a famine in Somalia, and this is not unheard of. There had been famine before in Somalia. July 1992, for whatever reason, the United States began paying attention to Somalia in the summer of 1992. And I have no insight into why that happened. It's interesting, George Bush, I think on the eve of the Republican Convention, you know, if you think of what else was happening here in the United States at that time, George Bush then began paying attention to Somalia and said, gee whiz, this is something serious we ought to do something about. In October, the United Nations launched a major relief effort to try to relieve the starvation in Somalia, and cynical commentators would tend to say that, well, we got estimates at that point that 90% of the population was malnourished. Others, authorities said 75%, but an enormously high percentage of the population. This is a population that historically is a peasant population. These are agriculturalists. Over 80% of the population has been involved in agriculture, so these would, I assume, be people with small plots of land trying to just, you know, scrape an existence out of the earth. In any event, October of 1992, we are saying that there are 1,000 people dying every day. I have no idea how you tabulate in a country like Somalia, how you would count that, but it was a graphic statistic. As I say, widespread malnourishment. I was mentioning a moment ago, the cynics at the time said, we've seen this coming for several years. Why do we have to wait until there's starving and dying children, you know, until they're the graphic pictures that play so well on the media? Why do we have to wait until that point to really get concerned? But we do. Then in December, the United Nations authorized the use of force for humanitarian relief, and the United States acted very quickly to send U.S. troops in. And if you remember our role was we wanted U.S. troops in place, and they would hold the fort for several months until the U.N. was prepared to come in. My sense was that the initial Somali reaction was fairly positive. The U.N. had, to some extent, a bad name in Somalia. Boutros Ghali, the Secretary General of the United Nations in particular, as an Egyptian, and as an Egyptian that many Somalis felt had ignored their problems or been hostile in some way, Boutros Ghali in particular was unpopular. And so all other considerations aside, it may have been good just because the U.S. would be better accepted than the U.N. that the U.S. went in the first place in December. May of 1993, the U.S. Turned over responsibility for what we were doing in Somalia to the United Nations. In June in 1993, then you had this ambush of the Pakistani, the U.N. force that was made up of Pakistanis, and you have the reprisals then against Aidid, who was seen as the culprit. It was thought that his forces had carried out this ambush, and so the United Nations struck back at Aidid. If that's an introduction, is there anything at this point that you see that I left out here? Any other any developments along the way that strike you as important?
There was one in January of 91. When Barre fled, the U.S. Embassy was evacuated under fire by, the embassy was under attack. And the new $60 million embassy that was gutted to the wall after these people came through Frankfurt and I helped them, but they evacuated all the people there. So we had nobody on the ground there really until last summer. I mean, the embassy was simply closed. There was no official American presence there at all. So when all these other things were happening,
we had no capacity to talk to the various parties.
No, we didn't have anybody there. Who,
from when to when?
The first U.S. special envoy was sent last fall sometime.
Okay.
I don't know. Former ambassador. We didn't get anybody on the ground until last fall. So we still don't have an ambassador there. It's a special envoy. So it's not really an embassy. They offer you 50% more money if you go for a 6-month tour. So, and they're not having a lot of applicants for some reason. But they're trying to start something up in that. The UN headquarters is the old American embassy. Can you see that building? That's old American embassy.
And the United Nations, I think, had not had a large presence. There was some special ambassador that I read about who it was argued was having some success in talking to people but had no support from the UN. He was really, he happened to be designated by the United Nations, but he was really very much operating on his own, and that made it somewhat more difficult for him to work things out. Any other contributions you can make in terms of this historical overview? Yeah, Louise?
Wasn't there a lot of church aid to refugee camps where people were fleeing from the tribal fighting, and Lutheran World Relief, and I'm sure was helping some of those camps a lot?
I would think there probably was. I don't know that, but I would think there probably was a great deal of that. Part of the problem was difficulty getting, well, let's put the map back up. Part of the problem was difficulty getting relief supplies to the distribution points. That it was trouble unloading it at the docks to the extent that one warlord or another controlled the docks if stuff was being shipped in, or then once it was unloaded, transporting it to the distribution centers.
Are there also a lot of Somali refugees in Kenya and
I would be certain there are without being able to cite documentation. At least Kenya. But probably throughout anywhere they can go and feel relatively safe. And one of the other things that seemed to have happened as the U.S. forces initially came in and pacified certain areas, then a lot of the young men with the guns simply moved out and moved somewhere else. So they took their fighting. If we occupied Mogadishu and made Mogadishu relatively safe, then they moved somewhere else and continued their squabbling. Or they hid their weapons, assuming there would be a future when they would be able to use their weapons. Well, what I wanted to go to next is to ask the question, what's the problem here? As you think about this situation, what would you say is what would you describe as the basic problem? And I'm asking that because I think we can come up with several different basic problems, and then I want to try to understand the causes of those problems. Yeah.
One thing that strikes me is
okay.
I'll get to you. Let me put that up. I think even more so that we're trying to force a national presence on to it.
Yeah. Okay, there's a general kind of argument that
the expectation that they have to be a nation.
That the West has created the international system, and in doing that has said the international system consists of nation states. So wherever you are, you have to live in nation states. That's how it has to be. That's what we say. That form has not worked real well in Africa, and I don't think it's worked real well in the Middle East. I think there are cultural reasons that that's a problem. What was yours?
I was just going to see a breakdown of the infrastructure. There's they have to rebuild it to get the country working again. The court system, you know, the whole way we run the country then is all just broken down into tribalism.
Okay. Can I make that just a general breakdown of order?
Okay.
And you mentioned courts.
Courts, and you know, it just seems like, you know, their whole way of governing, you know, the government and everything is not in place anymore.
Okay, so government generally?
Well, there's shameless international trade in arms, which is going on everywhere but here too.
Okay, so
people are making money off of misery.
So say that there are just too many arms available. Oversupply.
Well, not just in Somalia, but there are people interested in selling, making money off the arms that they're delivering there.
Okay.
Who is in control at the moment?
Well,
that's the problem.
There's no one, and everyone is in control.
Yeah, it has broken down.
To say who's going to go in there, I mean, how can we go in there and say, well, we're going to do this?
Well, yeah, I guess as a political scientist, I tend to look at the other, a slightly different question. How is it possible to do that? Can we do that?
Why
is it practical?
They should have somebody there that would be a leader. They need a leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have a couple of candidates.
Yeah, they have several self-promoted candidates who are willing to do that, play that role. If everyone else would just lay down their arms and let them take over.
Is the famine issue the absence of food productivity in the country or the absence of money to buy food, or does it?
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, I think, but I didn't want to put that problem up, but I wanted someone in the audience to suggest it. But famine is certainly a problem here as well.
And is that true in the end of June 1993? Even with all the United Nations relief, the famine is still alive and well. It's a poor choice of words.
Absolutely. Nobody can farm.
And this is one side of it, is the difficulty of farming. I think there are some regions where there is some planting and some farming going on, but it's not enough, obviously not enough to feed the people. But as you suggested, there are multiple causes for the famine. So that's a problem. Do you see any other, as you look at this, do you see any other problems you would identify as central, fundamental problems?
Well, it's not important to anyone anymore. I mean, during the Cold War, you can remember reading, you know, the Horn of Africa was going to be, you know,
the next
start of big problems. And I mean, one of the reasons when after the embassy closed in 91, I mean, everybody said, well, Somalia, you know, so the embassy's closed, you know, so we don't know what's going on there. It with the changes, you know, in the world and everywhere else. You know, Africa especially has really sort of fallen off in importance, and places that we used to think were very important have simply not become important to us in that political, you know.
Yeah, my sense about that is in the 1960s we had the Congo crisis, mm-hmm. and the United States and the Soviet Union each took sides in that, and even though we both more or less supported the United Nations in its effort to try to resolve that, we thought Africa was important. This is a new battleground in the Cold War. Sometime after the Congo crisis in the early 1960s, my sense is we wrote off most of Africa, at least most of Black Africa. South Africa mattered, and we continued to be concerned about South Africa. The Horn of Africa mattered, and so we cared about Ethiopia and Somalia. But and you may recall that history differently, but my sense is a lot of this we just said is insignificant, doesn't matter to us. And now with the end of the Cold War, we can do that also with the Horn of Africa. Now the North Africa is another matter, and we have paid more attention to North Africa. Louise.
Tied into the no sense of nationhood, tied into the oversupply of arms, tied into the famine and breakdown of order are these ancient feuds, which is a part of Bosnia's trouble too, but these ancient feuds with Ethiopians, with clans among themselves, and it's strange, the Muslim religion doesn't seem to hold them together because it's Muslim clan against Muslim clan. But those feuds are devastating.
Okay. What would have been the traditional way of, at this point I want to start getting into analyzing these problems, what would have been the traditional way of ameliorating that situation? The problems among the clans, do you know how traditionally those kinds of things would have been worked out?
Military. But a local war.
Yeah. It would have been local kinds of feuds.
They also had a central sort of council of clan leaders that we tried to revive. They would meet and sort of decide who was going to lose what and who was right. And those clan leaders could somehow, you know, still be brought back together. That would be the only way, since people would be like, they don't have a feeling of nationhood, would have all the leaders of those clans.
Yeah, so there were a set of traditional authorities of elders in the clans, and I think those elders, while there would be clashes, sought to manage the relations among the clans and prevent things from getting out of hand.
What are the economic dimensions? It's got to be something.
That there's something economically valuable that Somalia produces that the world wants.
Well, there's talk of oil.
Yeah, there's oil there, but they've never done anything to get it. But they said there's oil in the area.
Is that why we're there?
Of course not. U.S. government's position, we're not there because of oil. No, good question. But
yeah.
That's been raised in European press quite a bit because Chevron and some other U.S. oil company has sent in, regardless of all this, people to do surveys. So there are people in there doing certain U.S. corporations, oil corporations. But that's, of course, not why we're there.
Might be the best thing that happened. Or at least give some reason for the rest of the world to take an interest like we do in Kuwait. Otherwise, that would have been ignored.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I come back to my fundamental concern, which is we've got to be able to put the country together in some way. Otherwise, what I think you do is if there is an oil-producing area, you create an enclave. We protect this enclave and let the rest of the country just go about its violent business, as we've done in Angola. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is
but
the process in order to try to restore it?
Well, presumably this is what we are interested in, and this is what the United Nations is interested in. Again, I want to come back to this analysis here a little bit, and we can try to talk about the capacity to do that. I think we've, in terms of nationhood, I don't know if there's anything to add to that, that this is missing there. The way the international system works, you seem to need a nation. You need a nation with an effective government. They don't have that.
Part of that, you need leadership and vision. If you don't have that, you'll never get a nation.
Well, it strikes me that economics supersedes any sort of ideology, and that we're focused on ideology. But now I know nothing about this, but it seems to me that there's an absence of economics, which is the reason for the absence of the rest of us.
Okay, the
only economic thing that's going there is arms.
That's very true. Okay, if we identify, say, a lack of a functioning economic system, some such thing.
That's part of the breakdown of order.
Indeed.
Well, okay, another way of looking at this is that Somalia had a functioning economic system 100 years ago or 150 years ago. which was a barter and peasant agriculture. And what happened is the outside world came in and said, we're making you colonies, and we're bringing you into the modern industrial capitalist economic system. And Somalia really wasn't set up to play a role in that kind of system. They had a system that functioned as long as they were left alone, but once they were dragged into the world economy, they no longer had a system that had much to do. And that, you know, to the extent that there's a problem there, that you can see it in that sense. Now, if oil is going to be the everyone else, then is still in the same state they were. And is it going to, if you need to bring order to the society, are you going to make enough from oil in terms of oil revenues to pay the cost of organizing this society? I think I may be asking questions that are too broad and questions at the same time I don't have the beginning of an answer to. But it would seem a local warlord or someone, if they could control the territory and make the deal with Chevron or whomever, that they might end up in a very strong position. But let's...
Could I say something about
sure.
that? Because I think your barter system still existed. Even though they imposed that outside economic system, the peasants, and they still traded with salt and in the marketplace and whatever. So that was still existing. But I think with the bandits and the breakdown of transportation and safety, then the barter system couldn't even function.
Well, when you have subsistence agriculture, and up until, say, 5 years ago, as I say, more than 80% of the people were engaged in subsistence agriculture. These are people, as long as you don't have serious drought and as long as you don't have political interference, are mostly able to feed themselves. It's a working system. It's not 20th century industrial, but it's a working system and it feeds people. What happens is when there is this kind of major breakdown of order, then it becomes very problematic. So why don't we turn for a moment to that issue of famine, and in a sense ask your questions a little bit, but why does famine occur? Why? What do you know about famine in this area? And I'm asking this partly because I ran across some interesting articles as I did research on this, saying that famine is often a result of political developments. That there can be natural disasters that contribute to it, but often it's politics plays a role. So what was happening in Somalia in the last 5 years or whatever that has made it harder for people to feed themselves?
Displaced.
Okay, dislocation. People have been moved from their lands where they did farm.
We did the Bible study with Joseph and his family, and he is in Egypt and feeding people off of their famine, and his family comes to Egypt to get food. But there's political stability at that time in Egypt for the clans to go somewhere to get their food. So I would think you're right in the fact that the political stability in the area is what causes non-famine.
Okay, and the lack of political stability aggravates the problem. Another thing you have is you have these marauding military forces going about and doing several kinds of things that aggravate the famine. At one point, they're just seizing food. They're not well fed, they're not, you know, well paid by the government at all or by whoever is sponsoring them, and so they just take food from the peasants, which leads to famine.
Also, there's such an intimidating factor. I mean, if you're a farmer, especially a peasant farmer, I mean, you've got to be out there in the fields every day and watching over your crops. And I mean, if they take your seed corn, then we have nothing. I mean, you can't. Or if they take what your crop, and then you have to eat your seed corn because you don't have a crop anymore. I mean, it takes, I don't know what the growing cycle there is, but I would assume it's four to six months before you get.
Yeah, I don't. I don't know either.
Is it maize or millet?
I would imagine to be more sorghum and millet type
and millet.
Of crop, which doesn't take as much rain as maize.
Yeah. Does it pay more to join one of the marauders and carry a weapon than it does to stick on the farm?
Mm-hmm. So probably more attractive if you're a young guy. families staying on the farm.
If you want to survive.
So, and this would then draw off some of the manpower for...
Exactly.
Another thing that seems to have contributed to this, that I ran across in one source, was as we started providing aid, there was a lot more U.S. money, a lot more dollars in Somalia, and that aggravated inflation. So to the extent that people were supported themselves, not by growing crops themselves, but by making some kind of product which they sold, and in turn they bought food, with the inflation the price of food rose, but the price of the products that people made did not rise. And so they found themselves unable to afford food, to the extent they were relying on buying it rather than bartering for it. So even that aggravated the problem. So you have all of these problems contributing to the famine. Let's go back to the oversupply of arms. Why are there so many weapons? Okay, there are countries such as Russia that are selling arms because it's one product they have that's wanted on the world market. Is Russia the only country that's selling arms in the world?
Well, the leading seller of arms is the United States.
The U.S. does pretty well in selling weapons as well.
Also, all the European countries are heavily into business.
China, there are a lot of countries that see a real export potential. And Israel's not too far away from here. So you have a lot of countries willing to sell arms if they have someone there, if there is a willing buyer that has cash to spend on arms. I'm not sure how that fits into other sorts of, well, there's another source of arms as well, and that is the fact that we had been arming Siad Barre. And so there were a lot of arms, either Soviet arms from when they had been there, which would some time ago, or U.S. arms
that were in the country. 80, Somalia was the leading recipient of military aid outside of Egypt in Africa. I mean, $200 million a year.
So there are a chunk of arms that are left over from our relationship with Barre. So all of these are sources of arms. I would suggest, one of the things I recall reading about this situation is that the gangsters and the warlords would hold up the relief trucks, seize some of the food, and then transport it to Kenya and elsewhere and sell it. That one of the ways that they made money was selling the food that was relief aid in other countries where people could buy it, and in turn they made money that they could spend on arms or paying the thugs that worked for them. So you have, in economic terms, we have an interesting kind of economy, but it's not at all an attractive economy, and it's an economy to some extent fueled by the aid we're trying to provide. To the extent we're trying to put money in there and move food in there and do other kinds of things to relieve the situation, that gets distorted because of the conditions on the ground in Somalia. I'm not sure where you want to go next. Which of these other problems do we need to elaborate on?
About the ancient feuds, I mean, are they Sunnis versus Shiites? Are they?
They're all Sunni. It's 99% Sunni.
And it's ethnically almost homogenous. When you compare it to Bosnia or something, they all speak the same language as Amharic.
I think there are two languages.
Amharic?
No,
The official languages were Arabic and Somali. And I'm not sure what that tells you about what was spoken, but I would suspect many people could speak either of those. One of the things about Somalia is it's a very homogeneous country. As you look at so many countries around the world where you do have religious and ethnic divisions, those are not present here. So it is clan relations rather than the other sorts of relations. Now, obviously, those can be very problematic. But some of the problems that make Bosnia or make Yugoslavia a very difficult situation are not present in Somalia. Now, I have a sense, and I've not seen this clearly in many places, that there's a kind of power struggle between the clan elders, who would be the traditional authorities, and then these new warlords. I'm not sure what, Farai Deed, what his position would have been in the clan structure, but he's emerged as a sort of an entrepreneur in this situation.
What's ever happened to Muhammad in this? I mean, after this superficial ceasefire and agreement, at least after it came up here, I've heard news.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat with you.
All the news related to Somalia always referred to Aydin, but I didn't hear much about Muhammad. I don't know if somebody else did.
I'm not sure. I don't have an answer to that. So, does anyone? I mean, this is one of the other major warlords. There are some lesser warlords. Each seems to have carved out a chunk of territory.
And we're still talking mostly about Mogadishu the surrounding area. I mean, the rest of the country. I mean, the German troops I know that were sent from Germany went further south to one of the places that starts to J. But one of those places, and they were there basically to help train police force. I mean, to try to restart a police force. Germans are very good at police.
So this is.
But they're trying. I mean, because that's the first. I mean, if you don't have any, we were talking about breakdown of order. You have to have, the traffic is crazy. Everything else is crazy. They're trying to train people, the police force, and then do some infrastructure work with water recycling.
Who's the warlord that we just tried to kill?
ID. And there is a third fellow whose name, I'm not sure of his name, Morgan. Have you heard of Colonel Morgan or something. I'm not sure what his, it's a title and a name. But he apparently is a relative of Siad Barre. So if he is successful in taking some chunk of the country, Siad Barre may reemerge as a figure in some fragment of Somalia. Well, I don't know. To this point, I think this has been pretty grim. Is there anything else that we? Not all of these need to be talked about. Is there anything else in terms of our basic problems that we should mention?
Just the fact that feeding people and educating the children.
Okay, we need to resolve the famine. You're looking a little more broadly. It's not just a matter of police, that you have to put a whole social structure back together again.
Future generations?
I guess that's part of this reason to me that this situation seems so grim is that need to reconstitute a social structure. What do you think about what's been done to this point? The United States sending in troops, for the most part, now we confiscated a few arms, but for the most part, we did not see our role as confiscating arms. If someone came along and they, in the city and they were blatantly had arms out and were showing, we'd take them away from them. And we did on occasion raid places where we thought one warlord or another had a stockpile of arms. But for the most part, we did not, the U.S., when the U.S. was operating in Somalia, we did not see it as our mission to take away arms. We were trying to maintain order.
Are countries still selling arms in Somalia?
I'm sure someone is.
I mean, it seems like that would be helpful if that was not, but it was probably a way.
You have the money, somebody's
got to get it. Every country will say, well, if we don't, somebody else will.
I don't think there's been an official arms embargo against Somalia.
I haven't seen anything about that.
The way there is in Bosnia.
Which has not, in Bosnia's case, has not prevented the flow of arms. It would make it more difficult. It would probably raise, economically, it would probably raise the price of arms, but I don't think it would stop the flow. But it could help. That would help alleviate the situation.
Well, it seems to me one of the solutions would be to try to revive and support this council of elders that in the past had, I mean, since you can't destroy the clans have been there longer than any of them, their independence. Maybe get these elders And somehow, I don't know how you'd support them in the right way, but, you know, perhaps giving them, you know, access to funds and to, you hate to arm them and then, you know, set them off against each other, but.
Are you advocating like a confederation type of government rather than a central government?
Yeah, see if these clans could just start out and sort of police their own little areas and then have maybe a looser form of central government.
A loose one for either currency or foreign policy or.
Yeah. And if they could then, maybe that, you know, get, perhaps get them to be in charge of food distribution or give them some sort of, I don't know how it would work. And I, U.S. policy, we don't really have a policy. I mean, we're trying to support a variety of things to make a central government work. But it seems to me this Council of Elders, which has some history to it, would be the best thing to support. See if they, you know, give them the power, or try to give them some power, and see if they could, reassert control over the clans. Because the clan method is actually fairly, you know, if your sense of, allegiance is to the clan, there's usually a lot of loyalty involved there and obedience in the whole structure of elders and families and people.
Yeah, those kinds of traditional ties and that sort of traditional authority generally is more effective than, you know, if you're trying to rebuild a country, that's where I would start also. But that's not at all easy, and it's not particularly easy when you have gangs that are well-armed.
And there might be a parallel in Tanzania when the British ruled Tanzania after the Germans, as a first a mandated territory and then a trust territory, they used this system that was called indirect rule. And what was meant by that, this is devised by Cameron, I believe, Lord Cameron, but in West Africa, I believe is where he devised the idea. But anyway, the idea was to use the local structures of authority and let them operate, and then the government would deal with whoever was responsible in whatever local area you're talking about. So you don't disrupt the structure that's already there, but you utilize it. And that was practiced right up until independence in 1961 in Tanzania, and continued sometime thereafter until, under Julius Nyerere, they felt they had enough national coherence to, through the parliament, they decided that there would be no more chiefdoms. Tanzania. We have almost 130 different ethnic groups, and the parallel I would have to draw would be an ethnic group with a clan in Somalia, not a different ethnic group, but I mean there is a parallel.
Yeah.
And I think until such time as there can be a feeling of national unity and cohesion and identity, using, as many of you have suggested, the local clan system would be the way to go, at least as an interim measure, I would think.
The difficulty is to get from here to there.
Yeah.
We have a situation where the economy is not functioning effectively, where someone said the infrastructure is broken down, where we're not, the system is not providing basic services, mm-hmm. And how do you get to a situation where the clans with the traditional clan structure are able to do that? Now, in countries where there's a gradual transition to from colonialism to civil rule, it's possible to make those kinds of preparations. And one of the countries I know best, Botswana, worked hard at working with the traditional leaders. They tried to create a representative democracy, but at the same time, they tried to incorporate the chiefs, the traditional, and they weren't strong chiefs. These were chiefs in a democratic kind of setting, but they tried to incorporate them into the political system so that they had the support of the traditional system while they modernized. And here you have, in a sense, a struggle between a modern form of government based on power and based perhaps on wealth, competing with a traditional form of government. And unfortunately, it's just terribly destructive.
There's also this controversy over whether we should be, I mean, there was an article in the New York Times on should we go in, should the UN restart up mandates, just say you can no longer control your country, your country's a mess, we're going to come in and set it up for you. And there's a lot of controversy as to who is deciding, you know, will it always inevitably be poor countries that are backward or whatever, who we're going to be told, well, you can't really control yourself. I mean, Siad Barre and these other people say, and this warlord say, you know, get out, we'll work it out ourselves, and sooner or later someone will emerge victorious. I mean, that's a problem with who, you know, who's going to pay for us to take over Somalia.
Yemen
is already trying to do that in Cambodia, and so a lot of, you know, Bosnia is there.
What happened after World War I and again after World War II, the defeated powers had colonies, and we said, well, you can't keep your colonies. And as Howard was saying, they were made into mandated territories or trust territories. And some other responsible country then was given the responsibility of taking care of them. After World War II, with the trust territories, the idea was, you are preparing this country for independence. This is your responsibility. And we have a branch of the United Nations whose job it is to oversee that, to make sure that you are being responsible in preparing your trust territory for independence. And they have virtually all gotten their independence. The only remaining trust territory is a chain of islands in the Pacific that the United States is overseeing that, as far as I know, doesn't particularly want independence. They're comfortable in their relationship with the U.S. and would like to see that continue. But people are saying maybe the thing to do is to reinstitute that kind of, in a sense, big brother, that there's some country that's fairly well off and knows what it's doing, and that country will assume responsibility for Somalia or wherever else it is that there's just such an utter breakdown.
Just a question. I don't know too much about what's going on even recently, but why didn't we, the United Nations, distribute food through the clans, allowing the clan leaders to distribute food to their own clans, rather than setting up certain distribution points and kind of doing it ourselves? It seems to me if you give people food and they can feed their people, that's empowerment, but mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like we did that. Where am I wrong?
I don't have the answer to that.
The people with the arms didn't let it work that way.
Well, to some extent, the distribution, now when the churches have been operating there and other relief organizations have been operating there, and I don't know enough details about how they organized the relief that they provided.
What's
to answer.
Going on up north in the Republic of Somalia in the meantime?
It's, no one talks about it. I found virtually nothing about it.
For instance, is there a model of what they're doing that could be...
They have had, I do know...
They're doing well.
They are doing better. There has been some clan problems there as well.
So what can we learn from what they're doing that the rest of Somalia can do?
It's a good question, and there is a substantial portion of Africa that we do not pay attention to. In February of this year, the New York Times ran an article about conflicts around the world and came up with 48 civil conflicts going on around the world. Now, we are very much aware of a few of them. You know, we are very much aware of Bosnia, we are aware of Somalia, we are, I think, aware of Liberia, mm-hmm. We're probably aware of Cambodia, and I don't know, you can probably name a few more.
Very little aware of neighboring Sudan.
Of Sudan and the trouble in Sudan. And
for a long, long time, and that has religious ingredients for the struggle as well, which complicated that much more.
And
where the government's trying to impose an Islamic state on the whole country, and the southern half is largely Christian, and they don't want to accept that, understandably. And the result is tremendous famine. People are being wiped out by the government, its forces, and because it's so remote, we don't get television.
Yeah, somehow.
Coverage and what we don't see on television, we not by intention, but we just seem to be unaware of because we don't have ways of finding out.
So, I don't know. There are places you can go to get some more information about this. The Times carries some kinds of things. There are specialized journals on Africa that you can look at to, you know, to find more information. But even there, often the reporting is sporadic. Someone happened to be in this country, you know, a few months ago, and they wrote an article, and so you have an article on country X. That's how I ran across what I found on Somalia for the most part. So it's a lot of the world that we do not pay very much attention to. We're not much aware of. I think I saw today something to the effect that there are two American reporters covering sub-Saharan Africa. So it is not very well covered for us.
And we're proposing more and more emphasis there, making, you know, regional.
As economy measures.
Because we're opening them in the former Soviet Union, so we have to close them somewhere.
And there's a whole lot of areas there that we have a whole lot to learn about. As you have 15 countries where there was one, the world is getting messier. It has been getting messier in the last several years. I feel like it's time to stop today. If you want to come back and talk a little bit more about these kinds of issues, I would urge you to do that Thursday or Friday. Part of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to set up contrast. I think the problems in Somalia are in many ways different from the problems in Bosnia. And I compare my third example is Haiti. And I think the problems in Haiti are significantly different. To me, that might say to the United States, one country is a place where we ought to be going in and trying to solve things. We have some capacity to help. And another place might be a place where we say we just are utterly in the dark about what we can do. If there are 48 civil conflicts or even close to that going around the world, there's no way we can solve all of them. So it makes sense to be selective. The question, I think, is there any place we ought to be going in and trying to help? And what are the prospects in that case? So I invite you back in the future. Thank you all today.